Welcome to Radio Times in Review, our Friday show where we dig into the archives and find some of the best interviews from Radio Times past. I'm Marty Moscoane. First up on today's show, we'll revisit my conversation with Israeli writer Amos Oz on the 50th anniversary of the publication of his first book, Where the Jackals Howl. The acclaimed novelist recently made waves by detailing his childhood relationship with now Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, which included many incendiary statements about the controversial leader. Let's listen to my interview with Oz, recorded in 2011, following the publication of his book, Scenes from a Village Life, which he described as a novel in stories. You've written many books. Do you struggle as a writer? And by that, I mean, does it ever get easier over time?
On the contrary, it's becoming harder and harder. Is that right? Unlike a carpenter or a hairdresser who becomes more fluent with experience, for me, trying not to write the same book again, it's very, very hard to invent something new.
And when you say it's hard to write, does that mean that you struggle over words, over phrases, over characters, over a fresh story
every
idea?
Every word is a struggle. Every adjective, every adverb is a struggle because my mantra is precision.
Then it must be correct, precise.
Must be the right word and a fresh word, not just the right word, but also a fresh word.
This book is translated, as many of your books have been, by Nicolas Delange. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. How did you find, or how did Nicolas Delange find you, or how did you find him?
Well, I spent a sabbatical in Oxford, England in 1969, and he was a postgraduate student of theology. And I wrote a story about the Crusaders, and he wanted to read it. And I told him the story is in Hebrew, and he said, that's no problem. I gave him the story to read, and he came back to me 2 weeks later with a rather flawed English translation of the first few paragraphs. I was so impressed by his command of English that I said, I'm going to have this man as my translator if he agrees, even if I have to sit with him and explain every Hebrew word. By now, he has a perfect command of Hebrew, and he is probably the best translator of Hebrew into English.
The reason I ask is, and clearly your command of English is excellent.
My English is just good enough to tell him when I think he is wrong.
I was wondering about that.
Sometimes he will come up with two or three or four or five alternative idioms for a certain Hebrew idiom. He will vote everything and ask me, and I'll vote everything, I will veto everything, and he will ask me, so what is the English for this and that? And I'll smile and say, English is your department, sir, not mine.
It doesn't seem fair somehow.
Yeah.
I came across in this book, he uses the word higgledy-piggledy. Mm. I mean, that is in this book, and I thought, gosh, what's Hebrew? Higgledy-piggledy, what is that word?
It's an equivalent of a certain Hebrew idiom, which is untranslatable literally, but it's a good equivalent. And I often think that translating a work of literature is like playing a violin concerto on the piano. It can be done very successfully on one strict condition. Never try to force the piano to produce the sounds of the violin, which is why I say to all my translators, and I'm translated into 41 languages, I say to all of them, for God's sake, be unfaithful in order to be loyal. Look for an equivalent.
Your book has been some of your books have been translated into Arabic, and you were telling us that there's a Kurdish pirated.
Yes, I received a copy not long ago, a single copy of a pirated Kurdish edition of my tale of love and darkness.
Your memoir.
Yes.
That must make you feel pretty good.
Yes, I never expected to extract royalties from the Kurds. So, yes, it makes me feel good.
But if it's pirated, you're probably not getting a dime, right?
No.
And it has been translated. Your books have been translated, some of them, into Arabic. Has that been a struggle?
That has been very exciting. Of all the many translations of my books, it's the Arabic translation that moves me most. I'll tell you a little story about the Arabic translation of A Tale of Love and Darkness. Mm. 7 or 8 years ago, a young Palestinian Israeli student was jogging in Jerusalem. He was shot in the head and murdered by terrorists who mistook him for a Jew. His loving family decided to finance the Arabic translation of A Tale of Love and Darkness in memory of their beloved son slain by terrorists who mistook him for a Jew, and in order to improve the understanding between the two peoples. This Arabic edition was published in Lebanon by a very courageous Lebanese publisher and distributed all over the Arab world to a chorus of voices ranging from "How dare you distribute this Zionist filth in the Arab world?" to "We Arab writers should learn how to write such books."
Wow. And do you think that's what books can do?
That's what books
can do. Or should do, perhaps.
You know, books remove stereotypes. Books take us into the private lives of other peoples, into the bedroom and the living room and the nursery and the kitchen of other people.
I read somewhere, I guess this is talking about your life, that when you were a kid growing up in what became, I guess, Israel, is that you wanted to be a book.
Yes, life was so strained and so hazardous, and the future was so uncertain that I decided I'd rather grow up and become a book than become a man, because people are so easy to kill. Books are also easy to burn, but if I'm a book, then a copy of me may survive somewhere in the library in Philadelphia.
And it was dangerous because what was this, with the 40s or
it was the 40s? It was immediately after the Holocaust, and there was an immediate fear in Jewish Jerusalem that once the British pull out, there may be another Holocaust. The Arabs will come and slay all of us. So we lived practically between two Holocausts, or between a fear of another impending Holocaust.
And you were born in 1939.
That's right.
And grew up in Jerusalem.
In Jerusalem.
Neighborhood in Jerusalem.
Yes, I'm 72 today, which is the equivalent of being a 356-year-old American. I am older than my state. I saw the Boston Tea Party with my own eyes. I shook hands with George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. Treat me with respect, please. You are talking to
a sage.
You are talking to a sage.
So you were older than your country.
I'm older than my country. Yes.
But you, in a sense, grew up together, yes?
Yes, I have seen it all. I have witnessed all of it.
Your family came from
Russia and the Ukraine.
When did they come to what became then the State of Israel?
1933-34, just before the Holocaust, in time.
And did they have a sense of impending doom?
They were driven out by violent anti-Semitism and discrimination against the Jews. They were forced into going to Jerusalem, fortunately for them, because if Europe had not kicked them out violently in the 1930s, it would have murdered them in the 1940s.
Mm. But to be kicked out, I mean, is to leave something behind, is it not?
They lived a life of unrequited life toward Europe. They loved Europe and hated Europe. They were angry with Europe and heartbroken about Europe. They fantasized about Europe all their life. They were Europeans at a time when no one else in Europe was a European. Mm-hmm. Today it's not a big deal. Wow. Everyone is a European, and those who are not European yet are standing in line to become Europeans. But 70 or 80 years ago, the only Europeans in Europe were Jewish people like my folks. No one else was a European. Everyone else was a Bulgarian patriot or an Irish patriot or a Norwegian patriot. And for being European, those Jews were labeled cosmopolitans, they were labeled ruthless intellectuals, they were labeled parasites. But they regarded themselves as Europeans, and they were the first Europeans.
Mm. So you feel like you're the son of European parents?
I am the son of exiled European parents,
yeah.
Yes.
And forever that sense of exile?
Forever that sense of ambivalence toward Europe.
Right.
And we are, all of us, are either immigrants or children of immigrants. Mm. Israel is a refugee camp. Palestine is also a refugee camp. The clash between Jewish Israel and Arab Palestine is a tragic clash between two refugee camps.
So what were you like as a kid growing up in that house?
Well, I was bookish.
You liked books?
I was surrounded by books. Well, mind you, we had no television, we had no telephone, we had no radio, there were no computers. The only thing we had were books, and there was abundance of books in the house. My father could read 16 or 17 languages, and there were hundreds and hundreds of books piling in that tiny little apartment the size of a submarine.
Wow.
And it was everywhere, in the kitchen, in the bathroom, books, books, books. So I read. This was my world.
Did you have friends?
I had some friends, but it was difficult to keep friendships in Jerusalem, because in British Jerusalem, a curfew was imposed on the city every evening.
How early?
6 o'clock.
Oh, 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
So no playing outside?
No playing outside. knows we're playing outside, no seeing friends. Mm-hmm. And I was an only child, so I had only books.
You wrote about this in your memoir, but your mother committed suicide when, yes. You were just, what, 12 years old?
12 years old, yes.
Looking back, did you see a woman in despair, suffering?
Looking back, yes, but at the time I didn't realize it. Mm-hmm. I was very angry with her for killing herself. I thought of her as if she ran off with a lover without leaving us a note. I was immensely angry with her. Mm-hmm. I was angry with my father for losing her. I was angry for myself because I thought if I were a good kid, she would have stayed. I was angry with everyone for a long time.
So why did she kill herself?
There is no simple answer to this. The 600 pages of A Tale of Love and Darkness are a search for the answer, and there is no one-line answer to this question.
No. But something that haunts any family, it seems to me.
Yes. Well, you know, Tolstoy says that all happy families are the same. Each unhappy family is different.
Yeah. Does it feel like it was an unhappy family?
It was an unhappy family, yes. Mm. And that's what I write about all my life. If you ask me in one word what my 27 books are all about, I'll say families. Mm. If you gave me two words, I'll say unhappy families. If you gave me three words, you'll have to read my books.
Something else I read, and again, this goes back to your family, but that after your mother died, that your father and you never spoke of her.
Never. We erased her from our lives, not a word, not about her death, not about her life, as if she had never existed, as if she was a Soviet leader depersonalized by Stalin and forgotten. For many years, I did not discuss my mother with anyone. I did not discuss my parents with my new family when I raised a family. It took me many, many years to open this story and start treating my parents as if they were my children.
Mm, like your children.
Which is what I did when I wrote A Tale of Love and Darkness. Mm-hmm. I treated my parents as if they were my children.
But did it feel like it was something you just could not say, or it just you erased that discussion from ever happening?
It was too painful to discuss. And besides, there was nothing to say. I didn't know why she killed herself. My father didn't know why she killed herself. Probably didn't know either. There was nothing to say.
Oh. But you have talked, you wrote about this, and I guess...
Of course. Well, my anger subsided and was replaced by compassion, curiosity, humor, and longing.
Yeah. But it's interesting to me that you turned your parents into children. So you became their parents in order to understand them?
In order to write about them, I had to become my parents' parent.
Which happens with children, doesn't it?
Which happens with children, yes.
And your father, what happened to him?
He died quite young, at the age of 60 in 1970. But I still talk to him almost every day. We disagree on politics. We have vehement political debates every day, although he has been dead for 41 years now.
And do you win those arguments with your father?
You never win an argument with a father. Never. No one ever wins an argument with a parent.
That was my interview with Israeli writer Amos Oz, who joined me in the WHYY studios in 2011. You're listening to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. When we get back from the break, we'll revisit my interview with basketball star Julius Erving, also known as Dr. J. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We turn now to my conversation with basketball icon Julius Erving, known more famously and more affectionately as Dr. J. He joined me in 2013 on the heels of the publication of his autobiography, which detailed his childhood and his career in professional sports. The former Philadelphia 76ers forward changed basketball forever through his slam dunking ability and through his business savvy. Erving turns 65 this weekend. Here's a portion of my conversation with the doctor himself. You grew up in Roosevelt, Long Island. Your mom was a single mom, and she seems, as you write about her and even pictures of her in the book, a really powerful presence in your life, your mom.
The most. I mean, other than Jesus Christ, the most influential person in my life, for sure. Our circumstances in the beginning, my mother and my father separated when my younger brother was born. So there's 3 years between each of the children. So having an older sister and a younger brother, you know, I was the oldest male in the house at 8'4".
You're the man of the house.
So, you know, there were a lot of times in that period in which, you know, she kind of let me have my way and acknowledged, yes, you are the man of the house.
Yeah.
But she's the mother figure and the father figure. And fortunately, both my mother and father are from big families. So I had a lot of uncles and aunts and cousins, and people would drop by. Most of that first 13 years, we lived in Hempstead, Long Island, which is my original hometown, and Roosevelt's my adopted, and then Philadelphia's
the second adopted.
I feel at home in all of those places, but my roots are in Hempstead, Long Island.
Well, you describe in the beginning, it sounds like you were this word, a jumper. I mean, you were jumping and running and jumping, and seemed to have sort of a natural feel for just your body and movement. And I mean, it turned into basketball, but early on, you were a jumper. A jumper kid.
Not a jumper cable, right?
No, not a jumper cable.
Yeah, I used to like to jump.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, you know, my mother played a little basketball in her, you know, high school. And she went to junior college in South Carolina. So she played on a team. My dad played on a team. So they were familiar with basketball. I had uncles and cousins, you know, who were hoopers. I tried to play all the sports when I was young up until my second year of high school. And then I just concentrated on football and basketball, and then eventually basketball. So I think I was chosen by the sport instead of the one, you know, choosing the sport, because it was what I was kind of best suited for. And, you know, I could run and jump. I got slowed down, a leg injury, preteen years. And fortunately, when they stitched up the lacerated knee, they put a little spring in there.
Oh, is that right?
Make me a higher jumper. No, I'm only teasing you.
They did something.
It's an inside joke. Hey, whatever they did, it turned out well. I'm beholden to the physicians.
Let me go with something in your book, and this is you write, or you and your co-author write. I can't explain it, but even teammates can see that I seem to know where the ball is going before the ball goes there. I can watch a shot making its way to the rim and predict the trajectory of its carom. You feel like you sort of had that all along?
I think so, because when they teach basketball fundamentals, what they do is, see, you're on defense, so you have your back to the basket, and a shot goes up, and you're, you know, you have your back to your basket, and you're guarding your man, and now you have to do a pivot and try to put your body against that player to box them out.
Yeah.
So, you know, while you're doing all that, you pretty much got to see the person, you know, because you don't want to do a pivot and he runs around you. So you got to see them. So you really lose contact with the ball. And I always had a good feel with shots going up and with who was shooting, whether they were going to clank it, whether it was going to be short, long, left, right, and so on and so forth. And so it was a matter of, you know, knowing your opponents. And after you see them shoot once or twice, you know, every time that person jacked it up, I said, well, this is going to be a real high rebound because he can't shoot. And the ones who are going to make it, you know, you just box your guy out, you know, make sure you're between your man and the basket.
You make it sound very simple.
It's, you know, it's fundamental, it's fundamental basketball stuff. But to be an exceptional rebounder, and there have been some exceptional rebounders in the history of the sport. And I was for a long time, and in high school, college, and first half of my pro career. I mean, I was really an exceptional rebounder. You kind of broke the rules. You said, well, okay, I'll just check my man. I'll just put my hand on his chest, and I know where the ball's going, so I'll go get the ball. And as long as you can go and successfully retrieve the ball, then the coach wouldn't yell at you about not boxing your man out. Because, you know, that's something that is a judgment call. And if you have that extra ability to not have to do everything by the book to create, you know, in the space and in the moment, then it's going to give you an advantage. So I felt as though I had an advantage, and it made me pursue the ball that much more religiously, knowing that if my man got it, I was going to be penalized because I'm not really boxing him out the way I was supposed to.
But what's interesting, and I watch a lot of films of you playing in preparation for this interview.
Okay.
Oh, of course. I read your book as well.
You go, girl.
But, you know, you have such a beautiful movement. It's almost like choreography or some kind of dance movement, the sort of fluidity that you had on the basketball court.
Mm.
Did it feel that
way
for
you? Well, thank you for saying that.
Well, but did it feel that way
and
for you?
There was something that happened in my early years, in my 20s. There was a Russian dancer named Edwin Villela. We did like split screen movements.
Oh, yeah?
On a stage. And they filmed it. And, you know, it was like, do a pirouette. So he's the best at doing a pirouette. And he could do it. And then I would try to emulate it. And it was just a matter of trying to identify the similarity between sports motions and dance. And Lynn Swann was a very, very poetic receiver for the Pittsburgh Steelers for many years. And he did the same thing. There's certain players who, when they leap, they know how to land.
Yeah.
They know how to
but
come,
you seem to know
come
how to
down
do that.
Softly. And there's others who don't know how to land. And it's an accident about to happen. Excuse me, Jamal McGee. They're always teasing him because he's falling all over the place. And every time he goes up, you know, he's got this huge wingspan, but he's a little clumsy.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was that. And I remember that. And, you know, when you ask me this question, it makes me, you know, think about jumping out of the swings when
sure.
I was young and, you know, climbing up a fence and trying to walk it like a tightrope. And when you fall off, you know, you don't fall on your face, you fall and you land softly and, you know, get back up there and do it again.
You say something interesting about your attraction to basketball, which is that you liked the sort of security of the rules, the sort of law and order on the court, that was something, as a young kid, even growing up, you found attractive.
Well, that's true. You know, I mean, I have this terrible disease where I like to straighten things out.
Oh, is that right? Line things up?
Your stuff, my stuff, everybody's stuff. I mean, I like to see lines and columns, and I like for there to be order. I mean, I don't know if it gives me control or not, but it's just pleasing to me.
Right.
So tend to do things that are pleasing and migrate towards situations that are more comfortable than less comfortable. My family makes jokes about it or whatever. There you go.
Are you a
neat
Nick,
go.
Then?
Don't straighten up my stuff now. Just do your stuff. You know, so it's funny and it's so refreshing to meet somebody like that who likes order. And basketball, definitely, with the court, you yeah. know, being 90 by 60
right.
and, you know, having exact dimensions. So every court you get on, if it's regulation, it's going to be the same.
Unlike baseball, for instance.
Yeah. A lot of the fields are not the same. And you know, golf is one of those things where every golf course is different.
And you are a golfer
and
now.
I love golf. Yeah. I love golf. But there's an order in golf. It's just not from golf yeah. course to golf course. You got to bring something a little different. So that made basketball extra appealing, and it made it work. In terms of being coached, I could comprehend what a coach had to say about the fundamentals of the game very easily. I mean, you know, because I said, look, all right, here's what we're trying to do. We're trying to score on offense, and we're trying to stop them on defense. And the best way to do that is, you know, learn how to pass the ball, learn how to rebound the ball, learn how to score the ball, learn how to dribble the ball. That's all you're going to do in a basketball game, yeah. one or the other. So, you know, when you get the ball in your hand, you got one of those options. And if you're too far away from the basket, you eliminate one or more of those options. But always know what the options are when you get the ball. And when you don't have the ball, you're always trying to get yourself in a position where when you get it, you can be a triple threat or a quadruple threat. But there's only so many things mm-hmm. you're going to do.
You have a scene in the book where you're a young kid and there's some, I guess, some gangs or some tough kids in the neighborhood. They're trying to give you a hard time. You basically said run home. But one of the things you say about that was that you had an identity then. You felt you and perhaps it was from basketball, perhaps it was from your mother, your family, but you had an identity and that perhaps protected you from gangs or other temptations.
It protected me from joining or feeling that I needed to join to belong, and I needed that type of protection. I mean, I had very good protection from my mom and family members who lived in our housing projects in those first 13 years. And, you know, that's a formative time in,
sure.
in life in which, you know, you're making decisions. And we had a lot of time from age 9 to 10 when we were on our own and had to make decisions. So a lot of times I ran and other times, you know, you try to talk your way out of situations. So I think I was a pretty good kid. And one of the things that was really pressing in my mind was not making my mom's life more difficult than it already was, you know, knowing that you know, she was now doing domestic work in a doctor's office during this time before she became a hairdresser,
yeah.
and had her own booth and, you know, a whole 9 yards associated with that. But when she did the domestic work, I said, you know, this is very difficult. You know, working for peanuts and you're supporting, you know, 3 kids. I didn't want to make it any tougher for her. So odd jobs and collecting, you know, bottles and getting deposit for beer and soda bottles or whatever was, you know, part of the hustle. Mm-hmm. Part of the hustle as opposed to going out and, you know, hanging out with knuckleheads.
Your younger brother, Marky, mm-hmm. died. He was about, what, 16?
He was 16 when he passed.
And you found out after he died that he had undiagnosed lupus. I mean, it seems mm-hmm. like he had asthma. I mean, clearly mm-hmm. that was mm-hmm. obvious that he had these problems, but mm-hmm. but died essentially of undiagnosed lupus.
Yeah, yeah. He was asthmatic really from age 6 through 16, so he always, yeah. you know, had the inhaler, and,
right.
and he was the bedwetter, and he, you know, he was the sickly kid in the family, and having a big family in terms of the extended family, you know, there were some kids were stronger than others, and, you know, but we were all together and, you know, hooked up as one and always looked out for each other, so I always tried to look out for him,
yeah.
and we were different from one another because I was, you know, very athletic. My older sister, Alexis, was also Frida. Very athletic, so he was the one who didn't get the athletic gift, but you know he was very mental and he loved to read and you know and actually when he died he was his class president at Roosevelt mm-hmm. High School as a sophomore, and it was just a shocker to everyone because he always came back, you know, he always found ways to come back from being sick. So, you know, it was probably at that point the mm-hmm. saddest day of my life, even though I had lost other relatives.
Yeah.
I mean, this was my little brother.
Yeah.
And that's something you can't replace.
You lived through the 60s. I mean, you know, the Civil Rights Movement, the Vietnam War, the assassination of Kennedy, assassination mm-hmm. of Martin Luther King, the assassination mm-hmm. of Robert Kennedy as well. Were you political all that? I know you went to University of Massachusetts for mm-hmm. a couple of years. Were mm-hmm. you energized by the politics of that time?
Well, I actually went to college for 3 years and left after my junior year. So going in 68 and leaving in 71, mm-hmm. you know, it was the height of many things. The Vietnam War was still going on.
Right.
We had the civil rights, there was a political environment, and there was a lot of hatred in the country. You know, from a fundamental standpoint, the foundation with which I had been orientated to in my elementary years, you know, was patriotic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was an American and proud to be an American, and we were the best, and the red, white, and blue. We recited the Pledge of Allegiance every day. You know, we had prayer in school. So K through 8, there were a lot of things that I bought into. I bought into the American dream.
Right.
And then I moved to another community. It was kind of dramatic moving to another community, but the spirit of the American dream was still there. However, there were other things in my high school years that we got introduced to, you know, so we got introduced to, well, you know, I was always knew the teachings of Martin Luther King Jr., but, you know, now there was the Black Panther Party, you know, and there was the Nation of Islam. You know, kids in my high school were making these decisions
yeah.
about who was right, and it led to great debate. But I never wavered from, you know, my idea of being Christian and, you know, following Martin Luther King Jr., but I would listen to the others, but I just wouldn't bite. And I had really close friends who bit, changed their names, changed the paths of their lives. And I always kind of looked at them as, we could still be friends, but sometimes I'm going to have to tell you to shut up about, you know, what you're trying to convince me to do, because I already have my mind made up. And I am one of those people who, it's funny because when people ask me about my all-time greatest basketball team, I made my decision when I was 13 or 14. So the 5 guys I name, sometimes people don't even know who they are because I'm like, nobody's going to be better than these guys. I made this decision.
And you're not going to change your
and
mind.
I'm sticking with it, you know. we can talk more about that later. But the era and the time, you know,
sure.
from 1962 to 1972 or whatever, you know, it's, you know, free love, you know, hippies. I mean, there was so many things going on in the country and out of the country that the United States was threatened. And we needed people who had to make decisions And I looked for leadership. I mean, I looked, and Dr. King was, you know, the shining light out there saying, you know, things that come out of his mouth, I believe, because they make sense.
You did play for the 76ers, and as we all know, the sports fans in this city are famous or infamous for being opinionated. I mean, they're either root for you or they're going to root against you. How did you feel about the fans in this city?
I got a rousing ovation my first game, and I played my first game without practicing with the team.
Yeah.
I mean, I really signed after training camp was over, the exhibition season was over, and I signed, and I come in, I have a press conference, and then it's like there's a game the next day. There was a season opener against the San Antonio Spurs. So the blessing there was that we were playing against San Antonio Spurs, a team I had played against every year in the ABA. So they were a former ABA team. So I knew all those guys.
Yeah.
And I knew them better than the 76ers teammates knew the Spurs. So I came off the bench. Scored maybe like 18 points. Didn't have a good day at the free throw line. I missed about four or five free throws from the rust.
Remember that?
Yeah, I remember that first game. And it was like, you know, some of the fans, oh, now we got another guy here who can't make free throws. Because, you know, they had Wilt. Well, they had Wilt. And, you know, Wilt was like a 50-something percent free throw shooter.
Right.
So it's like, hey, here's our savior, and he can't make free throws. So somebody, you know, chimed in with that. But for the most part, it was a very, very arousing ovation at the beginning and at the end. And Doug Collins used to always say, you know, when he retired, he says, one thing I'm happy about is I never got booed in Philadelphia. So this chorus of boos came out, right? So I said, as long as I'm in Philly and as long as I got a mic in my hand,
yeah,
I need to never say that. Never say it, because it's just going to open the door for somebody to jump in. So I've been pretty lucky in that regard that, you know, we've had such a great partnership with the fans in Philadelphia forever. And one of my wishes in life is that always will be.
That was my interview with Philadelphia sports legend Julius Erving, who turns 65 this weekend. Happy birthday, Dr. J. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. When we get back, we'll hear my interview with Australian finger-picking virtuoso Tommy Emmanuel. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We listen now to my interview with Tommy Emmanuel. The Australian musician brought his guitar to the WHYY studios 15 years ago, and we were blown away by his energy and his unbelievable skill as an acoustic guitar finger picker. Emmanuel's abilities earned him an appointment as a member of the Order of Australia. He is one of seven players to be awarded the title of Certified Guitar Player by country star Chet Atkins and has been twice voted Best Acoustic Guitar Player by Guitar Player magazine. He is currently on a world tour, and Pennsylvanians will have a chance to see his lightning-fast fingers at work on March 13th when he plays the Keswick Theater in Glenside. Let's take a listen to a portion of my conversation recorded in the year 2000. Well, you actually started playing guitar when you were, what, 4 years old?
When I was 4 years old, you know,
little baby guitar?
I started out with, you know. And, you know, there was a band called The Shadows, and they were very big in Australia, but same as The Ventures out here.
Okay,
you know,
okay.
To be as old as us to remember all that stuff.
I know.
So that's the kind of stuff that I started out with. Mm-hmm. And then when I was 7 years old, I was out in the car with my dad. And
who was a kind of a music producer, right?
He was actually a mechanic who had a passion for music. But, you know, there wasn't a musical bone in his body. He couldn't tap his foot in time, couldn't do anything. Oh, yeah, he used to sing along, and it was monotonal, you know. Your cheating heart will, you know what I mean?
Did he play an instrument at all?
No, not at all. No.
But just loved music?
He just loved music. If you played, he'd just sit there, and he would be completely mesmerized,
wow.
You know. And when his little Thomas at the age of four, started playing. I mean, he used to take me around to people's houses just to show me off. It was so embarrassing, you know. I didn't like it at all. I'd be in tears, you know. But he'd say, "Come on, play something for them." And
you were part of the Emmanuel Quartet, obviously playing with your three siblings. So there must have been some musical genes at work somehow.
Well, my mother could sing, and she showed me how to play, you know, D and A seventh and G, and how to strum. Actually, how it started was when I started kindergarten, we lived right across the road from the school, and so I used to finish early because I was little. I was four, right? So I'd run home, and Mum would have this kind of what we call a wiggle space, you know, like a little time to do whatever she wanted in the afternoon before everyone else came home from school. We would sit there and she would play the Hawaiian steel guitar and I would play the
rhythm guitar,
how I got started playing rhythm for her, you know. And every now and again she'd burst into song and stuff, you know.
So it sounds like something out of the, you know, the Von Trapp family or something.
Oh yes,
like
the
that.
Hills are alive with the sound of music.
You've told the story, you started to tell it, but you've told the story about hearing Chet Atkins for the first time on the radio and the way you've certainly expressed it in the past. It was a real revelation. I mean, it
certainly
did
was.
Change your life.
Yeah, well, when you're a little kid, you don't know how to hide your feelings, do you really? You know, and I remember just my heart leaping in my chest, and I didn't know what to do with myself when I heard this sound. The first thing
what
I heard,
was
I think,
song?
Was
do you remember?
Windy and Warm. And I heard that, and I couldn't believe the sound and the feeling of this music. And I could hear that he was playing the bass part and the rhythm part and the melody part all at the same time. Most people around me, particularly adults, said, "Oh, don't take any notice of it. It's just a recording trick.
It's a trick. And
yeah,
this is your dad,
you can't really do that, you know." And I could hear it as plain as day. Yeah. I was 7 years old, and I absolutely knew it. I didn't listen to anyone. I just went for it and worked out how to do it.
And bought a lot of Chet Atkins records, I assume, right? And played them really slowly so you could take them apart and put them back together?
Well, the only thing I slowed down was to work out how he went, to work out how to do that. I had to slow down so I could hear that. Everything else I could kind of work out, you know. Although the funny thing about learning things off records, when you go back years later, you realize how wrong you got it. You know what I mean? Because you've changed, your mind's expanded, you've learned more things, and you go back and say, "Well, I had that all wrong." You know.
You eventually caught up with Chet Atkins, though. One of those stories. It's hard to believe. It's true.
And here's what happened. Some of my friends in Australia who were very supportive of me, and they kept recording me in their house. You know, I'd sit in and play all night for them. You know, and drink coffee and tell stories and have a great time. And, they sent this tape to Chet of me playing in their lounge room and didn't tell me because I wouldn't have let them. I would be embarrassed because I've always played for the love of it and for no other reason. You know, I always play for people and it's for enjoyment, you know. Anyway, so out of the blue comes this letter in the mail from Chet, handwritten, saying, "I really like your playing. Are you ever coming to the United States? We should get together." And I just couldn't believe it, you know. I wrote back. And I said, "Okay, I'm coming next year." So I had just enough money for the airfare and a hotel for a couple of nights.
And you went literally and knocked on his door, right?
I went to the office and I waited. 3 days later, I finally got to see him.
And you guys sat down and played.
Yeah.
And do you remember what you played?
Yeah, the very first thing we played was me and Bobby McGee. Thank you. so forth.
Were you nervous?
No, actually, I was surprisingly calm.
Really?
And the funny thing was is that, so I played the first verse and the first chorus, and he's just sitting looking, and then he joined in and with all the harmonies, and we soloed the whole thing. And then he stopped and he said, "Did I do that?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Oh, I don't remember that." Yeah. He has recorded so much that, I mean, how could he possibly remember everything? His legacy is unbelievable. There's no one even comes close.
Have you ever taken a lesson? I mean, I know you listened obsessively to records and things like that. But
I've never had a lesson, no. You know, there's a funny story. When I moved to Sydney in 1975, mm-hmm. I'd been on the road all my life, and I decided I better, you know, I wanted to move to Sydney, and there was a great place to play there. And I wanted to get studio work and play on people's records and things. And so when I got there, I was a kind of unique artist at that time, because every guitar player in Sydney wanted to be Larry Carlton and Lee Ritenour, you know. And I'd never even heard them. I'm a hillbilly, you know. So I came to town playing acoustic guitar and fingerstyle, and quite a few people said to me, "Well, you know, if you're going to get anywhere in this business, you've got to learn to read music." And they said, "Well, we can't believe that you can play and you can't read music. This can't be right." And, you know, I've never seen music, you know.
I'd never seen it,
no. And because I thought music was picking up the instrument and making a sound on it. That's what I still believe music is.
Not like reading or anything like that.
No, but my favorite composer, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. Oh. There's a guy who could write music on paper and not even go near the instrument. And right. That's his genius, you know. I was told I should go to this guy, the great jazz musician in Australia, George Goller. And he's a fantastic player and a wonderful gentleman. I had to sort of do an audition for him, you know, so I came in and I played, you know. "Lala, come back to me," so forth. I'm playing all this stuff, and he just laughed his head off. He said, "Get out of here." He said, "There's no way you're ever going to be able to read what you can play already."
Right.
But he did recommend another teacher, who happened to be a fellow Django Reinhardt nut like I am as well. So I got together with this guy, and he was supposed to charge me, you know, $30 for half an hour of his precious time. And after the first day, every minute was filled up with jamming on tunes, and he had such a good time that he said, "Look, forget about coming here. Come over to my place on Saturdays and we'll play. We'll drink beer and play," you know. So that was the extent of my lessons.
But are we hearing the result of just hours and hours and hours of just obsessive playing?
You have to realize that what I'm doing now, if I hadn't grown up the way I'd have grown up, I wouldn't be able to play these tunes or write them or feel the emotion of them, you know. And all my life I've put myself in situations, I've always dived in the deep end, whether I was prepared or not. I said, "I've got to go because mm-hmm. I need this experience." And I don't know what was driving me, but I know it was pretty powerful. I've been in jazz bands, I've been in rock and roll bands, I've been in country bands, bluegrass bands. I've played with orchestras, I've done soundtracks for films, the whole time trying to gather information and knowledge and stealing and begging and borrowing from everybody.
Right, and that's sort of part of that whole creative process, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Could you do a Beatles tune for us?
You bet I can. Let's have a bit of this. Recording trick. Any kidding?
Thank you. It's a little Beatles medley performed by our guest today on Radio Times, Tommy Emmanuel. Would it be possible to take a song, a difficult song that you've learned to perform, and sort of show us how you master that, whether you start, for instance, at one part of the song, whether you start slowly and build up to speed, or you take the hardest part first?
Well, you always, when you learn a new song, you don't play anything else for at least 2 weeks. That's all you play, because you've got to train your hands, the motor skills, to actually do this, because until you can play it comfortably, you can't possibly hear how you're going with it. And you can't possibly pour any emotion into it until you can physically play it. I would suggest taking it bit by bit. You know, like a simple song, for instance, like Freight Train. Right? Most people start fingerstyle guitar with that song because it's nice and simple. And the melody's on the end of the chord. Da, da, da. There's the chord. There's the chord. There's the melody, right? So for those people who are learning this song for the first time, take it a few bars at a time. So, this part. And do that again. You know what I mean? And then the next part. And until you can do each part, right? And then put it all together. And you know, the greatest bit of advice I can give somebody, apart from tapping your foot, is get yourself a little cassette player and constantly record yourself so you can actually hear where you're going. Because when you're concentrating, trying to do the mechanics of this thing, you can't really hear how you're going. And you may be rushing parts or slowing down, or it makes you aware of what sort of tone you're getting. And things as basic as that, and it's really important. Something more difficult, more stringent, would be, say, a tune called Train to Dusseldorf, which is a very fast song, right?
I like that song.
It has a run on the start of it, which is like this. So in order for you to play something like that, you need to be able to practice those things and get them smooth.
Now, can you do that very slowly for us?
And you can hear in that run that it's going G, F sharp, back to G. So the chords are going, but they've been spelled out by these notes.
You said toe tapping's important.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Why? Because you're kind of a human metronome. Is
that's
what it is?
You are. When people do something with the hands, they concentrate on the hands too much and forget about where the real soul of the groove comes from, and it's in your body, right? So when I'm playing, if I'm playing something, it doesn't matter how fast it is, this is always constant, you know? And in my mind, I'm always trying to think of one, two, I'm trying to hear all the other beats, even if I'm playing something at that tempo. You could think in your mind, one, two, three, and not be trying to struggle to, one, two, three, four, one, two, three, four, you know what I mean?
And we close out the show with more music from Tommy Emmanuel. This is Jersey Bounce from his 2013 collaboration with Martin Taylor. And that wraps it up for this edition of Radio Times in Review. For more information about the show, go to whyy.org/Radio Times. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks so much for joining us.